I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome to Radio Times. The announcement of Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy's retirement and the nomination of Judge Brett Kavanaugh to fill his seat has put Roe v. Wade in the crosshairs. The decision that legalized abortion nationwide has been under assault since it became the law in 1973, especially by the Casey decision, which opened the door to a number of restrictions and regulations. Today, access to abortion depends largely on the state where you live. If Roe is overturned, then it will be up to the states to control, to deny, and allow women's access to abortion services. I have hosted so many debates on abortion over the last 30 years on Radio Times. Roe still is the law. Abortion is still legal. Millions of women have had abortions. So today on Radio Times, a reality check on the status of Roe. And joining us is Elizabeth Nash. She's Senior States Issues Manager for the Guttmacher Institute, and she joins us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Elizabeth Nash, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, thank you so much, Marty, for having me.
You're welcome. Let me start with a couple of statistics. How common is abortion?
Abortion is very common. About one in four women will have an abortion in their lifetimes. So that's a very large amount of women. And throughout the year, nearly a million abortions are performed. So it's a very common procedure and a very safe one.
And when you look over, even since Roe, do we see the numbers of abortions going up or going down? How does it track, say, from the last 10 years or 20 years?
So we saw the number of abortions going up throughout the 70s, probably not surprising to hear that. And then we really reached a peak in the number of abortions around 1981. And since then, the number has been decreasing. So in 1981, there were nearly 1.5 million abortions that year, and now we're looking at just under 1 million.
Do we know why?
Well, we don't know exactly why, but we did do some looking into this over the recent time period, and what we were finding was that, especially during the recession from a few years ago, that people were deciding to delay childbearing, and also there's been more interest in using methods of contraception that are considered a little more effective, like IUDs. So as people are shifting their childbearing and their needs for contraception, we're seeing a lower number of abortions.
And is that because contraception is more accessible, or it works better?
Well, both. So I'm glad you asked that question, because when we started looking at what was going on, one of the things that was very much in the mind's eye and in the world was the Affordable Care Act and the contraceptive coverage guarantee that was provided within that. So yes, contraception being more available is incredibly helpful, and also being able to have a range of methods so that you can use the method that's best for you for whatever period of time, and then you can use another method or no method if you decide you want to become pregnant.
Like an intrauterine device or hormonal implants, things like that?
Exactly. Or, so those methods we call long-acting methods, because they can be used up for years, like in the case of the IUD. And then, but other methods, that are also effective around the pill, the patch, and the ring.
I describe, and we talk about Roe being the law that was passed in 73, legalizing abortion nationwide. But what is left of Roe, especially after Casey and even some of these other Supreme Court decisions? We'll get to the state-by-state variants here, but what is left of Roe?
Well, we still have the right to abortion. And yes, the Casey decision was really did open the door for additional restrictions at the state level, because what it did was establish what is called the undue burden standard. And that standard was about prohibiting laws that put an obstacle in the path of the patient seeking an abortion, but it's a very vague standard. And so really that door was opened. However, in 2016, we had a decision. The decision was titled Whole Woman's Health v. Hellerstedt, right, for those lawyers out there. And what that decision really did was put some guardrails around what the undue burden standard was and say, when judges are looking at an abortion restriction, they really have to use evidence around the burden of the restriction on patients to really evaluate whether there are any benefits to the restriction. And if there are no benefits and there's a burden, then the restriction must be struck down.
What's really striking is just how different states are. There was a story, I believe, using some information from Guttmacher in the New York Times this morning, comparing Mississippi and California when it came to access for access to abortion. For instance, in Mississippi, that has one remaining abortion clinic. California has 152. Using these two states, and I'm assuming these are at the far ends of the spectrum, help us understand what's going on here.
Sure. So what you're talking about with California is that both the availability of abortion with having a large number of clinics, although it's a very large state and clearly not everywhere is covered in the way that is best for every patient, but you have lots of clinics and you have policies that are being put in place to protect access to abortion. So you have laws around that really set the standard that abortion is available up through viability, and whenever a patient's life or health is at risk, you have laws that allow a broader range of providers to administer or perform abortions. You have just protections in place for staff at clinics. So you've really laid groundwork to make sure abortion is accessible. Whereas what we see in Mississippi are policies and an environment that are very hostile to abortion rights. Everything from burdensome and unnecessary regulations that make it hard to keep the doors open of the clinic, to prohibitions on insurance coverage of abortion and making it harder just to get to the abortion clinic itself with waiting periods and counseling requirements. And as all of these restrictions pile up, it just makes it harder and harder to get to the only clinic in Mississippi. And certainly the only clinic cannot meet all of the need there. So it's really two very different approaches that are being taken.
Including doctors available only a few days a week in Mississippi at this one abortion clinic. Do we know what kind of impact that has had on women living in Mississippi?
Well, we do, in the sense that we know that not everyone is able to access services, and we know that that patients do go to other states. So, you know, women, if you imagine a woman in northern Mississippi, she may go to Tennessee. A woman in southern Mississippi may go to Florida. And so you're adding in a whole other level of logistical complications to accessing services. So it's not just trying to arrange your schedule and the clinic schedule and navigate the restrictions. You're also talking about travel, taking time off of work, which may not be paid time off. You're talking about arranging for childcare. 60% of patients seeking abortions have a child. You're talking about having a car with gas or being able to travel to another state. And you're talking about hotel rooms and food and all of the other costs on top of the cost for an abortion, which is about $500.
Does that not meet the standard of undue burden that you mentioned earlier, coming from a Supreme Court decision?
Well, you would think that it would, because you have added, because by adding in these logistical barriers and these legal barriers, you have reduced access to the point where people have to navigate this complicated system. But what we have discovered is that not all courts look at undue burden the same way. And so some restrictions get upheld. And also there's the issue with the capacity to bring challenges. Not every restriction gets challenged, even if as you read it, you say it's an undue burden.
Let me quote something else from this article, and this is about Mississippi. It says, in Mississippi, doctors are required to state an association between abortion and breast cancer, a link that is unfounded, according to the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, raising the question about how that was passed in Mississippi, but also raising questions about these professional organizations and whether they have any influence when it comes to issues and decisions about abortion.
Well, yes, we have seen misinformation in abortion counseling for decades, and that's but one example. There are other examples around the idea that having an abortion will affect your mental health negatively, when in fact the American Psychological Association has found that there is no link between having an abortion and negative mental health outcomes. But we have seen these requirements get added into state law because the people who sometimes have the ear of state legislators and legislators themselves are bound and determined to use even misinformation to deter women from accessing abortion services. And all it does is it's detriment to not only the patients, but medical practice in general.
Does it tell us that the anti-abortion organizations and individuals have been much more organized and effective, especially when it comes to services at this statewide level?
Yes, in many states, they are more organized, and their voices are louder. I would say that in states, you know, primarily in the Northeast and the West, that is a bit of a different story. But it also doesn't mean that there are not advocates that support abortion rights in the South or the middle of the country. There are their voices need additional support to make more headway within the legislatures.
We talked about Mississippi and California. What about Delaware, Pennsylvania, New Jersey? How do they compare to each other?
It's a very interesting set of states. So if you think about them and you think about the political climate in each of these states, you know, things have been changing recently, particularly in New Jersey. But in Delaware actually was a bit of a shining star for abortion rights supporters last year when a law was enacted that set the frame for abortion access in the state that is now to protect abortion up through viability and whenever the patient's life or health is endangered. So really, you know, taking some of the legal standards and putting them into law, as well as repealing a number of unenforced restrictions that had just been cluttering up the books. So this was a real step forward in Delaware, while New Jersey, with the new governor, Governor Murphy, you know, the act, it hasn't been so much around abortion that we've seen progress, but we've seen progress around publicly funded family planning. And in Pennsylvania, Governor Wolf last December vetoed a bill. So the legislature's conservative and fairly hostile to abortion rights, and they passed a bill that would have banned abortion at 20 weeks post-fertilization, banned a very important method of abortion used after 12 weeks of pregnancy, and required a patient to go to the clinic for counseling and then wait a period of time, 24 hours, before getting the abortion. And the governor vetoed this bill. So that was a very important step to ensure that abortion rights are not further eroded in Pennsylvania.
We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. That's Elizabeth Nash, Senior States Issue Manager for the Guttmacher Institute. And we've been talking about how abortion services vary from state to state, and they vary widely. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, again talking with Elizabeth Nash, Senior States Issue Manager for the Guttmacher Institute. And again, we've been talking about how abortion services vary from state to state. She was just talking about Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. And again, you can join us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Elizabeth, do we know in states where it's harder to get an abortion, whether women are getting illegal abortions or doing unsafe procedures in order to end their pregnancy?
Well, it's very hard to identify who is self-managing their own abortion because it is, by definition, not legal and clandestine.
Sure.
So people are not, very eager to reveal that information. But we are looking at ways to understand what is going on because, yes, we do know that some pregnant people are looking to terminate pregnancies on their own. And so we don't have good statistics around exactly how many patients are doing that. But what we do know is that typically patients are looking to do this using medication, which is very different than what we were seeing from before Roe, right? If you're thinking about a back alley abortion or abortions being taking place in the 60s, you're thinking about all sorts of processes and procedures that could be very dangerous. And what we're seeing now is more like using some kind of medication to end a pregnancy. And that, in fact, is much safer. And so it hopefully would not result in some of the same kinds of situations that we were seeing before Roe. So I wanted just to make that point.
Yeah. Are you referring to morning after pills, some of these other medication abortions?
Yes. I'm specifically referring to the medication, some of the medication that is used in medication abortion. Medication abortion in this country is a medication process. You use a drug called Mifeprex and a drug called Misoprostol. And if you only take the Misoprostol, you could also terminate a pregnancy.
I'm curious, and of course this is very speculative. We do not know if Roe is going to be overturned or not. I mean, clearly it's been chipped away at. And it would require a case going before the court and obviously the Supreme Court making a decision one way or the other. But if Roe is overturned, how many states do you think would ban abortion outright?
Well, we already have four that have laws on the books. So this is Louisiana, Mississippi, North Dakota, and South Dakota, for those of you who are keeping track here, right? So those states all have laws that would ban abortion right when Roe is overturned. So you have those four states. And then you have states across the country where the political climate is very favorable for banning abortion. Right now, we're looking at, including those four states, about 29 states that we consider hostile or extremely hostile to abortion rights. And so you're really looking at states across the South and the middle of the country. You're really not looking at states along the West, particularly the West Coast and the Northeast. And then you throw in a state like Illinois, kind of in the middle. So you're looking at a large swath of the country that could be very interested in banning abortion.
In fact, you found that there are 10 states that kept their pre-Roe v. Wade bans in effect, not enforced, but they are in effect. Would they then become enforced if Roe is overturned?
For those laws, actually, there would have to be some kind of action taken. And a lot of those laws, so there are 10 of them, a lot of them are in places like Alabama and Arizona and Wisconsin, right? So you're looking at states that are fairly conservative politically right now. And for those laws to take effect, it would probably need some kind of government action, like an attorney general opinion or the legislature to step in. So it wouldn't be immediate, but there's the real issue that those steps would happen shortly after Roe was overturned.
An email from Adam saying, Marty, you stated that the morning after pill is an abortion pill. I don't believe that's true. Can you clarify? Yeah. Can you clarify,
yes.
Elizabeth? Go ahead.
Yes. Thank you, Adam. It is not an abortifacient. It actually is a contraceptive method. These terms do get confused, but what is called the morning after pill is a more also commonly referred to as emergency contraception, and there are various kinds. It is also it is available over the counter and by prescription, and depending on the type that you take, it can be effective up to 72 hours after pregnancy or 5 days after pregnancy. 72 hours after unprotected sex or 5 days after unprotected sex.
Words matter when having this discussion. I appreciate that comment. Let me read an email from Lucinda. She says, I'm very interested in how abortion laws affect women who have lost a pregnancy. I've had two friends in different states. One lost a pregnancy, was able to have dilation and extraction. The other lost a pregnancy, had to deliver a stillborn baby. One friend was in Pennsylvania. The second friend was in Virginia. I'm guessing they have different abortion laws. Can you speak to that, Elizabeth?
A bit. I'm not a medical provider, right? But yes, it, oftentimes how a loss of a pregnancy is dealt with, particularly a loss of a pregnancy at later stages, the laws can affect that. And, you know, if we think about how intrusive that is, and if we think about what that means for the person going through that and their family, then, you know, we can think about the importance of that we need privacy rights and the ability to make decisions for ourselves, and being able to deal with the loss of the pregnancy in the way that's best for us, in the same ways that we deal with any pregnancy decision. And I'm really sorry for her friends.
Yes, absolutely. Lucinda, thanks for that email to Radio Times. And again, you can email us, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. How many states have waiting periods, and what is the thinking behind a waiting period?
Well, the thinking behind... Over half the states have waiting periods. 27 states have waiting periods, and they vary from 18 hours all the way to 72 hours, including South Dakota's waiting period, which is 72 hours business days. So it doesn't include weekends and holidays. But the theory behind a waiting period is that a patient hasn't thought about this decision, that they need extra time to consider what they're doing. Well, in fact, what we know from research, from surveying abortion patients, is that they've made up their mind. Well over 90% of abortion patients have made up their mind before they pick up the phone to make that call or to make that appointment. So the idea of a waiting period is really simply a delay tactic and simply a way to make it harder to get an abortion, especially when you have to go to the clinic for the abortion counseling and then come back, say 72 hours later for the abortion itself. It can really make things very difficult logistically.
And how about ultrasounds? I know there are states where, I don't know if women are required to look at an ultrasound, but what are some of the rules and regulations related to that?
Yes. So there are, you know, really a number of states require an ultrasound to be provided. And clearly, ultrasound is used as part of the preparation for an abortion oftentimes. It helps date the pregnancy. It helps with the location of the pregnancy in the uterus. They're all very good medical reasons for it. But there are states that have really gone into medical practice. Really, it's politicians inserting themselves into medical practice to say, hey, you have to perform an ultrasound and you have to show the image to the patient. You have to sometimes offer or give the patient a printout of the ultrasound. There are typically, part of the law typically allows the patient to cover her eyes so that she does not see the monitor. And there are also times when the provider has to give a verbal explanation of the image that is being seen. All of this is designed to deter a patient from accessing abortion services and to shame them.
Just to follow up, and then we've got a second guest who's going to join us. So a woman doesn't, she can avert her eyes or cover her eyes. She doesn't have to look at the ultrasound, but it has to be shown to her.
Exactly. In many states, not all of the states with ultrasound requirements have that, but that is, it just goes to the whole point of shaming women and creating further stigma around abortion.
That's Elizabeth Nash, Senior States Issue Manager for the Guttmacher Institute, and we've been talking about how abortion services vary from state to state. Well, back in 2015, Amelia Bano wrote on her Facebook page that she had had an abortion the year before at Planned Parenthood and was grateful for the care she got and happy that she wasn't forced to be a mother. She ended with the hashtag #ShoutYourAbortion that went viral with other women sharing their experiences. And as our guest Elizabeth Nash has said, abortion is a common medical procedure. About a quarter of all women have had an abortion, but many women do not talk about it. Amelia Bano joining us on Radio Times. Amelia, nice to have you with us on the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Marty.
Well, let's go back to 2015 and your decision to post this on your Facebook page. What was your thinking?
You know, I'd had this abortion the previous year, and as you sort of indicated by reading my Facebook post, it was not a negative experience at all, which wasn't sort of what I'd heard abortion was supposed to be. It was, in fact, an experience that I felt just really grateful to have had. I received excellent care from the people at Planned Parenthood. I felt the support of my friends and family. I live in Seattle, Washington, which is, you know, obviously one of the most liberal places in the country, and I just felt supported, and I had a great level of access to the service. And I also just didn't feel conflicted about my decision. So all in all, it was just sort of a thing that happened, and that was that. And I was really grateful to have had my abortion. And then in 2015, when Planned Parenthood was under attack after being targeted by a group of anti-choice terrorists who edited together a bunch of propaganda videos purporting to show Planned Parenthood selling fetal tissue on the black market, which is absolutely not true and never has been in any way. And they, the Republican Congress launched their first effort to defund Planned Parenthood to the tune of like $450 million. And I was really incensed. I think in part because I had had my abortion at Planned Parenthood in the previous year, it felt sort of strangely personal, and it just felt so unfair. It felt like this thing that I knew to be good was being decimated by a lie, and that I wasn't using the full range of my voice to stand up for them. And I sort of started to notice that me and my girlfriends and women friends in Seattle just like weren't talking about our abortions with one another, even though the place where we live is one of the places you would think that that would happen more than others. And as I started to do that, it started to hear Me Too. I started to hear
a different kind of Me Too. A different kind of Me Too.
Yes, exactly. And so, you know, at the time I was tending bar, I was in graduate school, and I started to bring up my own abortion, and other people started to say, yeah, I've had an abortion as well. And we sort of started to say to ourselves, like, why are we not, talking about this? If we're pro-choice women who are angry about what's happening to Planned Parenthood, that's really saying something, that we're not talking about our own abortion experiences. So the day that I wrote my Facebook post, I just sort of you know, it was just off the cuff, and it was an articulation of this frustration that was building inside of me, and that I was like perceiving to be happening in my community all around me. And it, I think, spoke to a frustration that was clearly very pervasive, and that a need that people had to talk about their abortions. Because after I hit post, within a couple of days, the post, as you said, had gone viral, and hundreds of thousands of people who had abortions used this hashtag #ShoutYourAbortion to talk about their own experiences, often for the very first time.
Well, Amelia, let me pick up on a couple of things. And I'm curious about just the range of responses that you've gotten. I'm sure you've gotten other women who have talked about their abortions, maybe with a different kind of experience than you've had. And I'm sure you've gotten a lot of pushback as well. What has been the range that you've heard from women?
I mean, it's infinite. I mean, there are, I still hear about, it's now 3 years later, and I still hear abortion stories that are either circumstantially or emotionally things that I had never previously been able to imagine. You know, every single kind of person has abortions for every single kind of reason you can imagine. And these abortions make us feel all sorts of different kinds of ways. Right. And we've really not heard these stories before because they've been so effectively suppressed by the anti-choice movement. And as you mentioned, I heard from a lot of them as well, and continue to. But, like, as far as the, you know, the backlash or whatever, it, of course, people have tried to make me and others speaking about our abortions feel unsafe. You know, my home address was released by Tucker Carlson's online platform, The Daily Caller, when this was first happening. And yeah, it was scary. That was the whole point of releasing my home address.
Sure.
You know. And on one hand, it's important to talk about the fact that the anti-choice movement has very deliberately, very effectively terrorized people who have abortions and people who perform abortions into silence. You know, that's the only reason it's considered a brave thing for me or anyone else mm-hmm. to speak openly about having had an abortion, because they've dominated the conversation with this hateful, absurd, dehumanizing rhetoric. So we have to acknowledge that cultural context. But at the same time, sure. I'm not...
You know, Mele, if you don't mind, I hate to jump in and interrupt you here only because I'm looking at the clock here, and I want to just get a response from Elizabeth Nash. Elizabeth, as you mentioned, something like a quarter of all women have had an abortion in their life. Why the silence?
Well, I think Amelia, you know, hit it on the nose. It is all about abortion opponents using their power to keep us from talking about many important things around abortion, whether it's access, whether what it's like to provide. They intimidate patients on a daily basis. I remember one time when I was in Colorado and I was headed to a Planned Parenthood clinic, and my driver, who happened to be a woman, said to me, okay, now I'm going to drop you off here because the protesters will not be here. And when you need it to leave the clinic, please call me so that I can come and get you and help you avoid the protesters. That kind of intimidation is very real, and it's very hard to deal with, not only for those in the movement, but for those patients who aren't necessarily expecting that kind level of intimidation.
Amelia, we have 30 seconds. I apologize for that before we have to say goodbye here. So does this hashtag live on?
Yes, Shout Your Abortion is now in our third year as an organization that creates places in art and media and events all over the country for people to talk about their abortions. We have a book coming out in the fall, and people are really ready to do this. People are ready to talk about the way that abortion has allowed them to live their best lives and define their own experiences on their own terms. And that's a change that I think is truly irreversible.
Amelia Bono, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you're welcome. And Elizabeth Nash, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me, too.
You're welcome. Go to WHYY.org, and we will carry on our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We tend to associate religious organizations and clergy with the anti-abortion movement, but back in the 1960s, before Roe v. Wade, a network of Protestant and Jewish clergy helped thousands of women get access to safe, legal, and illegal abortions. They called themselves the Clergy Consultation Service on Abortion and did their work in a number of states. Joining us to tell this little-known story is Gillian Frank. He teaches in the program of American Studies at the University of Virginia. He's the co-host of a podcast called Sexing America, which explores how the history of sexuality shapes our present. He's currently working on a book about the Clergy Consultation Service on Abortion. And Gillian Frank, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
This group got started in 1967. There were so many issues that clergy could have championed at that time. Why abortion for this group?
So these clergy were already championing a number of issues, including civil rights, the anti-war movement. But in their ministry, in their pastoral counseling, they were increasingly encountering women with unwanted pregnancies who didn't know what to do, women who had seen what were called backstreet abortion providers, and they were coming back mutilated, exploited, broke, damaged, and in tremendous amounts of spiritual, physical, emotional pain. And so these clergy, in encountering these women, began to seek solutions. They were also responding to a wider upswell of awareness about abortion. Many denominations were issuing statements saying that abortion reform was necessary, that women ought to have control of their own bodies, and that they ought to exercise choice, so that it was their moral responsibility and obligation to control their reproductive lives. And so after New York State failed to pass a reformed abortion law in 1967, a number of clergy got together and decided that they couldn't wait for legislatures, that they needed to engage in civil disobedience and direct action to help women who they believed were suffering in quiet and in death, and to counter what they called the miseries and heartbreak of backstreet abortions.
What was their, if I can put it in quotes here, what was their religious argument then for abortion?
There was a number of religious traditions in this group, but the basic idea was this, that there were higher laws and moral obligations transcending legal codes, and that they had a pastoral responsibility and religious duty to give aid and assistance to all women with what they called problem pregnancies. So they believed that, you know, there is a period during pregnancy or gestation where what they called embryo life was present, but there was no living child on who a crime of murder could be committed. And so they believed that the woman's life ought to take precedence. And they were informed basically by an idea that it was called situation ethics, that the complex realities of everyday life ought to dictate morality, not some sort of overarching, unbending, inflexible moral code. And so with this idea in mind, this idea that we need to meet women where they are, address their pain, and help them, they sought to give them choice to control their own reproduction.
You've written about a Reverend Charles Landreth. He was a minister at a First Presbyterian Church in Tallahassee, Florida, talking from the pulpit about the need for abortions for these problem pregnancies, as he described them. And I think comparing that, and this was 1971, comparing that to today, you don't often hear that coming from a pulpit today.
I think that it may not often be broadcast in the same way that it was now. I think what has shifted is that the religious right and the anti-abortion religious right have captured the narrative and have captured popular culture. But, you know, when a Unitarian congregation or a Reformed Jewish group or a number of social justice and religious organizations speak affirmatively about women's right to control their contraception and reproduction, it's not in the news in the same way. But there has been an ongoing tradition, and today there's groups like Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice and others that speak to this legacy that the Clergy Consultation Service initiated more than 50 years ago.
Now, they were working, obviously, before Roe v. Wade, so when abortion was illegal. How did they evade the law, or did they evade the law? Just how underground was this movement, this organization?
It varied from state to state, but the basic idea, the founding group was in New York City, and then it rapidly spread across the Northeast and then across the Midwest and California and the rest of the country. And there was various degrees of openness and secrecy. But you would have them taking out newspaper advertisements or courting reporters for front page stories where their phone numbers were posted. And so in May of 1967, the first group of the Clergy Consultation Service announced itself, and their phone number was posted, and this became syndicated across the country, and they were overwhelmed with phone calls from women. And basically, they argued that what happened in the pastoral counseling moment, in that sort of intimate private space between the clergy and the woman or the couple that they were helping, was private, that the state had no right to intervene there, and they were protected by this. They also did things like they sent women across state lines for abortions. So when possible, of course, in places like Philadelphia, they would try to use the local hospitals. But most of these were very cost prohibitive, and many hospitals refused to offer women therapeutic abortions. So the option was send them across the state line to make prosecution more difficult. Or they would send women out of the country to places like England, where it had legalized abortion in 1968, to Puerto Rico, where it was largely unregulated, although it was illegal, to Mexico, where, again, it was unregulated, or to Canada. And so what they created was a national and international abortion referral network where every aspect of the procedure was researched and vetted to the best of their ability.
How did they find doctors that were willing to do this, knowing, of course, that it was an illegal procedure?
In places where it was legal, like England, they would send female members of their group, whether it was clergy or laity, to go and vet the doctors, ask them if they would be available to do it. Oftentimes, rabbis or ministers would approach members of their congregation. One rabbi in Philadelphia told me that he would go up to the OBGYNs in his congregation and say, "I'm telling you that you need to perform abortions. This is a social necessity and a moral good." And they would prevail upon members of their own congregation. They would also hear from women who the underground abortion providers were, and they would go and vet them, and if they were trained and qualified, they would begin referring women to them. And then they would ask the women for feedback, and this was so important. They let the doctors know that everything they were doing was being evaluated, and that if there were any complaints, any misdeeds, any sorts of exploitation or price gouging, that they wouldn't send any more referrals to them. And the idea was that the clergy didn't get a cent for this kind of service, but the abortion providers were making thousands and millions of dollars. And so there was a lot of money at stake that caused them to improve services.
And do we know how many women had abortions through this clergy program?
The numbers are hard to ascertain because many of the records were destroyed over time or destroyed in fear of police raids. But I have some documentation that suggests that it's upwards of 250,000.
Wow. Over how many peer, how many, until Roe v. Wade, I guess?
From about 67 to about 73.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Gillian Frank. He teaches in the Program of American Studies at the University of Virginia. We're talking about a program, a network of clergy back in the 1960s, early 70s, called Clergy Consultation Service on Abortion. And they worked to ensure that women have access to safe abortions when abortion was illegal, co-host of a podcast called Sexing History. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. We have an anonymous caller who wants to join us, and go ahead, you're on Radio Times. You're on Radio Times. I don't think we have them, but I will read what it says here. And Gillian, probably speaking a little bit to what you were just talking about, this woman said, I had an abortion before they were legal. I was a teenager. I'd never had a gynecological experience before. I did it in Spanish Harlem. No one spoke English. I lived to tell the tale. And it sounds as if this group of clergy were concerned about people like that.
Absolutely. And so they would hear these horror stories about women being blindfolded, of not knowing who was performing the abortion on them, of unclean, unsanitary instruments, of women being coerced to perform sexual acts for their abortion provider for extravagant fees, like $800, which translates into at least $15,000 in today's currency. And so they would hear these stories of exploitation, of unsafe provision, and of fear, and they were motivated to act, and they wanted, again, to end the miseries and heartbreak of backstreet abortions by offering women the opportunity to see trained, compassionate professionals and to get the counseling that they needed and wanted.
What role did they play then in Roe v. Wade becoming the law?
In many ways, the clergy were involved in legislative activism. Here in Pennsylvania, they would speak before the state legislature. They would advocate on behalf of women and tell legislators that they needed to reform or abolish abortion laws so that women could have control over their bodies. Over in Texas, where Sarah Weddington worked, she was closely affiliated with the Texas branch of the Clergy Consultation Service. In the companion case for Doe, the appellants were members of the Georgia Clergy Consultation Service. So these clergy were everywhere lobbying and advocating for legal reform, if not the abolition of abortion laws.
We have an email from Bob who says, just very simply, I was part of the Clergy Consultation Service in Pennsylvania from 1972 to 1974. Were there certain states where they were more active than in others?
Absolutely. So they were active in 40 states. Some of the biggest branches existed in places like New York, California, Michigan, Iowa, Indiana, Illinois. There was a huge branch in Florida. They were all over the place. At its height, it had at least 2,000 clergy members. And I hope, Bob, if you're listening, that you'll contact me so that I can interview you.
And hopefully Bob is listening. Chances are he is. And Bob, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499 or get us a message about how we can get in touch with you. I'm curious, Gillian, why this is such a little known story, and perhaps it's my ignorance, but as I was reading about it, I was saying to myself, I don't know about this.
I think one of the things, as we remember the history of abortion and we think about the history of religion, we seem to think that religious actors are against sex, are anti-sex, are anti-abortion, are anti-contraception. And this is a narrative that we associate with the most conservative edges of certain religious traditions. And they've been successful since the 1980s with the rise of the religious right in rewriting a popular memory as well as a historical memory. Historians of sexuality and American historians have also been a little lax in telling the histories of liberal religion and sexual and the intersections of religion and sexuality. There's a growing cohort of people who are working to correct that now. But as a result, there's been a blind spot in thinking about the legacies of liberal clergy. And part of it is these folks just don't fit into our narrative. It's a bunch of clergy men and a number of clergy women telling people to control their reproductive abilities, that they have a right to separate sex from reproduction, to enjoy sex, that they have a right to abortion. And they treated these matters very seriously. But it's not the people we associate with the movements for sexual liberation. And one of the things I think we need to take away from the story of the clergy consultation service is that the sexual revolution wasn't just secular. It was also a religious liberal revolution as well. And that much of the language that we have and many of the ideas we have don't only come from secular sources. They come from religious sources that encouraged creativity, that encouraged autonomy, and that encouraged women to seek equality both in the bedroom and in everyday life.
But it's interesting to think that this narrative that seemed pretty powerful in its quote-unquote heyday, that this narrative has gotten lost.
I think that's true. And again, I think that's a result of how we tell the story of religion after Roe. And part of this has to do with the story of religious realignment. Once the conservatives captured the Southern Baptist Convention, once the Southern Baptists officially became anti-abortion and aligned with Catholics who were anti-abortion and dominated the religious right, we have a narrative that we associate religion with prohibition and anti-abortion. And I think that misreads what has happened since Roe, which is a number of religious actors and organizations continue to support reproductive rights. A number of the clergy who I've interviewed continue to work with Planned Parenthood, opened up their own abortion clinics, continue to fight for all forms of reproductive and social justice. But I think that the spotlight wasn't on them in the same way. So I think that failing is one of historians, but also of the media, to continue to spotlight the important and ongoing presence of a religious left tradition.
We're almost out of time here. We talked to a woman who had had an abortion and went public with it. Do you think some of these religious people, these clergy people, felt silenced by the culture, the narrative?
Many of them have felt forgotten. When I interviewed one nanogenarian, a 90-plus-year-old clergy, he said, "I've been waiting 50 years to tell my story." But others have been visible and ongoing in it. And I think that it's a matter of us all listening to their stories while they're still with us and inviting them to speak with us to recapture the religious traditions of the past, but also to look to folks like the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice and a number of other groups who are carrying on in these important traditions and speaking about issues of reproductive justice in new and dynamic ways.
I hate to say this because Bob, who was part of Clergy Consultation Service in Pennsylvania, is on the line, but we have no time to take his call, and I don't want to interrupt him, but we will hook him up with you, Gillian Frank, and you can carry on your conversation. Thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
That's Gillian Frank. And again, he teaches at the Program of American Studies at the University of Virginia, currently working on a book about the Clergy Consultation Service on Abortion, and again, co-host of a podcast called Sexing History, exploring the history of sexuality and how it shapes our present. Well, that's it for today's edition of Radio Times. To be honest with you, we thought we were going to get inundated with phone calls. Not so much. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.